Okay, so let's start in Mark 8. Mark 8. And if you look down, there our passage this morning begins in verse 14, but I want to back up just to look at the transition between verse 13, which was the account we looked at yesterday, last week, and verse 14, because there's something there that's very important. It's very subtle, but it is very important. Jesus has just refused to give the Pharisees a sign from heaven. Remember, that was what they were asking for. Give us a sign from heaven. Jesus refused to do that. And in his refusal to give them a sign from heaven, he was also refusing to acknowledge their authority as teachers of Israel. He was refusing to legitimize their teachings. They have, for a whole year, undergone a process of hardening their hearts and refusing to listen and refusing to turn to Christ, to Jesus. In that section before verse 13, Jesus pronounces a kind of judgment. You're not going to get any more signs. No more signs. And he leaves them to themselves. He says, okay, this is the pathway you've chosen. You may go that way. I'm now leaving. He leaves Galilee. He gets in the boat. Now, the transition there from verse 13 to verse 14, we have to read into. You never want to read something into Scripture, but this is there, so it's not quite reading into Scripture. Something happened that Mark doesn't amplify, and that is that Jesus doesn't go alone. He doesn't get in the boat and go by himself. The 12 come with him. Now, let's think about the 12 for a second. They've had to leave many, many things since Jesus called them and they followed. They've had to leave many things. They've had to leave their life's work. We've said that before. They've had to leave their daily family life. I mean, they didn't get divorced or run out on their kids and their family. They're not with them all the time anymore. They're with Jesus every day. And so they don't see their families like they used to. They had to give up whatever future they'd kind of planned out for themselves. It's no more of that. It's not there anymore. They have turned their backs on almost everything, but this moment is very important because when Jesus looks at the Pharisees of Galilee and says, no more, and renders judgment on them, the disciples then, when they follow Jesus into that boat and they go across to the other side, also turn their backs on the most influential men in Galilee. These are the guys who shape public opinion. These are the guys who everyone looks up to understand what to think, how to think, what truth is. And so to follow Jesus here, the disciples have now set themselves publicly at odds with the most influential people in their own community. That's important to see, because it's important for us, I think, to see, because to follow Jesus for us also involves this frequently. It frequently involves you personally and us corporately deciding to be at odds with the most influential people in your school, at work, on television, and on the internet. It is, in many ways, a Christian calling. A call to be a disciple is a call to be countercultural. I don't mean that in the cool way, like in the 60s. It was kind of cool to be countercultural. Now you can try to fashion yourself now to be stylishly countercultural. No, I mean countercultural in the way that people who consider themselves countercultural will think you're very uncool. That's the kind of countercultural I'm talking about. You're not going to fit in with the people who call themselves countercultural because now they're part of the culture. You're not going to make it. You are sometimes, many times as a Christian, having to make decisions and take stands that people will look at you and they will not like you because of them. Now, in today's world, and I think this is a good thing, a very good thing, to be considered a racist is no one wants that. No one wants that because that puts you on the outside of the community, as it should, because racism is a horrible sin. But do notice, it's already happening, and in the next 10 years, we can't expect anything different. Upholding an orthodox or a biblical view of sexual morality is going to increasingly put us in that same category that people have in their heads for bigots, racists. That's a big thing. That's how far outside of our culture we can find ourselves. We do in some circles already, but that we will increasingly. Are you able to do that as a disciple? Are you able to be despised in that way for the truth that Christ proclaims? That's the kind of decision that the disciples are making here when they get in the boat, because now the Pharisees are left behind. They know these guys. They know their families. They're going to talk. They're going to hold these guys up for ridicule. They're going to hold their families up for shame. It's a turning back on the culture. They're turning it back on the culture. Now, the reason that's important to see is because the disciples, especially in our text today, look really stupid, right? Don't they? I mean, Jesus is going to make them look like knuckleheads as we go on through this text. So it's important to see that these guys are disciples. They have made the right decision in following Jesus. And so Jesus' exasperation toward them here, his kind of frustration toward them, is nothing like, in fact, it's utterly different than the kind of groaning grief that he had for the Pharisees last week when he turned away from them, when he rebuked them. These men are his disciples. And so while Jesus corrects and he rebukes and he disciplines his disciples, he will never leave them. He'll never get in the boat and go to the other side of the lake. He's never going to leave them. He's always going to struggle to bring them closer to himself. That's true for you too. That's true for you too, because we're going to make stupid decisions in our lives as well, just like these disciples, we do every day. But because you're a disciple, Jesus will never groan like he did toward the Pharisees and say, oh my goodness, and leave you. No, he will get in there and he will struggle for your soul, he'll struggle for your heart, and he's going to draw you back to himself because you're his. You're his sheep. That's what he does. All right. So now let's go ahead and having set that context, the context of discipleship, let's go ahead and look down at verse 14, and our text begins with this note. Now they'd forgotten to bring bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. Now Matthew indicates that they realized this after they'd gotten to the other side. Maybe they were there, they got hungry. Hey Peter, why don't you go get a loaf of bread from the boat? And he goes back, and there's just one. And it's not a big loaf. Remember, Ann was talking to us a couple months ago, about the kind of loaves these are. These are little biscuits. Little pieces of bread for 13 guys, 13 grown men, so it's not enough food. And you got to think, you can't just whip down to the Weiss, right? You can't just whip down to Wegmans and go pick up some more bread. They seem to be in a place that's remote enough where not having enough bread is a problem. Now, in the rabbi-disciple relationship, it is the disciples. This is not just the relationship with Jesus and his disciples, but any rabbi and any set of disciples. It is the disciples' job, it's their task, it's their calling to take care of their master. So it is they're the logistics guys. They have to find places for them to stay when they're traveling. They have to find transportation. And it is their responsibility to procure food for any journey they take. And that means that these guys failed miserably. All of them, all 12 of them, I'm sure as the discussion went on, they were pointing fingers at each other, but they all dropped the ball. And to me, that is incredibly encouraging. I love this kind of thing. When I see them mess up, I just feel so good about myself. It's encouraging. I'm fairly okay at certain things as a pastor. I'm okay at certain things, and maybe better than some other pastors at some of them. And I'm pretty bad at others, or worse than other pastors at others. But compared to the way that I ought to serve Jesus, compared to the excellence that I ought to bring to my job, compared to the excellence that Jesus deserves, with which he deserves to be served, I am pathetic. I'm quite pathetic. He deserves perfection. He deserves excellence. I don't give him that. Not always. I mean, I try, but I don't give him that, either by negligence or just because I just don't have the ability. I get in the boat and forget to bring the bread every day. And so do you. Just think about it. In what ways do you serve Jesus here at Good Shepherd? In what ways do you serve Jesus? Now, if you're a believer, there should be an answer to that question, by the way. Like they should have something that you're doing, right, instead of just sitting in the pews. Now, we do want a Good Shepherd, if you do serve in some kind of ministry, in any kind of ministry, we do want you to be a learner first, a disciple first. And so we would ask that you be in a mission group or a Bible study, and then decide from there where you're going to serve. But you need to be pouring out what God is pouring into you on a regular basis for the extension of Jesus' kingdom and for the completion of the Great Commission. That's just what Christians do. Now, I've had many conversations with people in this church, and it goes something like this. I'll say, hey, you know, that person would be really good at this particular ministry. So I'll talk to this person. I'll say, hey, will you serve in this way? And the answer will be no. Right, and not that rude. It's a little bit less rude than that. But no, and I'll say, okay, well, why won't you do that? And something like this often comes up. Well, I'll make a mess of it. I know I'm not the right person. I can't do this. I'm not able to do this. Surely someone else could do better than I could. Now, the answer to that question is yes. It's always yes. Did you know that? Surely someone can do better than you can at whatever ministry you have. And surely someone can do better than I can at the ministry I have. Someone can always do better. But the fact, and it is a fact, it is a truth that I love, the fact that Jesus chooses to extend his kingdom through the church. Think about that. Think about how inefficient that is. Through the church means that he's already built your incompetence into his plan, right? And my incompetence. He's planned for that stuff from the beginning of time. Now think about it. With one word, Jesus could do in a second, less than a second, what it's taken him 2,000 years to do through the church, right? It's inefficient. Why does he do it? I don't know why he does it that way. Well, I do know. I have an idea of why he does it that way. He does it because it's... He doesn't call you to serve because it's good for him, because he needs it. He calls you to serve because that's how he builds his people. He's how he builds you up. That's how he builds you up. You serving, you pouring yourself out for the gospel. Not for his good, but for yours. I'm going to forget. If you've been in the Good Shepherd for any length of time, you know how good I am at forgetting. I'm going to forget. I'm going to fall down. You are too. I'm not going to be excellent. But thanks be to God, I don't have to be excellent because Jesus is excellent. Jesus is excellent. So don't ever say, I can't do this because I'm not good at it. No, you're not good at it. Of course you're not. Neither am I. You don't have to be excellent at it. Jesus is excellent, and it's his church, and he has built, again, incompetence into the system. That doesn't mean we don't try, but it does mean we are not expecting perfection. All right, so the disciples don't have enough. Think about the picture here. The disciples don't have enough bread. What they do have, what they have brought, is insufficient, and it's their own fault. And it's their own fault. Now, the disciples here at this point, if we take this picture, are in the same position as the Pharisees, as the crowds, as the Gentiles, as Israel. Mark has been painting this picture over and over again through his gospel. No one has enough, he's been saying over again. No one has enough. What we do have is insufficient, and it's our own fault. Over and over again, he's been banging that drum. That truth is the starting point, not just for Mark's gospel, but for the gospel that Jesus preaches. Jesus says, you don't have enough. I do. Turn to me. That's what he's been saying. So now, you might look at this next comment by Jesus and say, what on earth? Why does he go to the Pharisees and to the Herodians after they realize they don't have bread? What's he doing here? Well, let me see if we can help with that. Jesus, overhearing that they've forgotten bread, that they've proven insufficient, thinks it's a wonderful time to bring up the leaven of the Pharisees and the Herodians. Watch out, he says in verse 15, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. This is Herod, but Matthew says Herodian, so he's probably talking about the whole group of people there who follow Herod. Now, leaven makes bread rise. I'm not a bread maker. Anne is the bread maker in our family, but I do know that leaven makes it rise. You don't need much, just a pinch. It goes through the whole loaf. It makes the whole loaf rise. Leaven, as it is used here, is used metaphorically, and it is a metaphor for corruption, for sin, for false teaching. Just a little bit of it, of the leaven of the Pharisees, just a little bit of the leaven of the Herodians, Jesus is saying will work its way through the whole. It will corrupt. What is, we have to ask, the particular leaven that Jesus is referring to? Well, let's start with the Pharisees. Who remembers, I asked 8 o'clock, no one got it, maybe you will. Who remembers what the first purpose of the law is? Why? What's the first reason God gave his people his law? Who knows? Thank you. Yes, that was really quick too. Got it. On the spot. The first purpose of the law is to lead all men and women to despair of their own ability to follow it, and therefore to seek out God's mercy and grace. That's the first purpose. You haven't gotten there yet. I hope you get there today. You can't follow the law. You are insufficient for it. You need Jesus. The Pharisees, as we've seen, added regulations to the law that obscured that truth because their regulations made the law doable. I'll give you an example. Seventh commandment, do not commit adultery. For the Pharisees, you could keep that commandment if you never talked to a woman who was not with her husband or with her father. And if you did talk to a woman who was with her husband or her father, you really would want to direct your comment to the man who would then kind of communicate it to the woman. And there you could keep the law against adultery. I'm not saying that's necessarily bad advice, but that was the way they'd understood keeping that law. What does Jesus say about the law against adultery? He says you can break that law in your room, by yourself, just by what goes through your mind and your heart. So it's doable. If you do the Pharisees thing, it's doable. I could never commit adultery if all it took was making sure I don't talk to a woman without her father or husband present. However, if it's all about what goes in my mind, out of my mind, I won't talk about me, I'll talk about you. You're going to commit adultery. That's just what's going to happen, right? So what the Pharisees have done then is the Pharisees, again, have taken the law, they've taken their traditions, and they've used them to persuade themselves that they have what it takes. They have enough to fulfill the law on their own steam. That's what they've done. So when the disciples see, they recognize, we don't have enough bread. Jesus says, yes. Yes. You don't have enough bread. Keep that in mind. Remember that. You don't have enough. Beware, be cautious of the Philistines who think they have enough. You don't have what it takes. Remember that. Never forget that. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees who refused to acknowledge that. Now, Herod and the Herodians. Now, the Herodians, which I think he's meaning here, Matthew tells us this, are Jewish advocates of the Herodian dynasty. And so generally willingly they've given up some of the distinctives that God has called Israel to have among the nations so that they can serve Herod and promote his interests. Now the Herods, as you know, were not powerful kings, but they were, not popular kings, but they were very powerful and they were very wealthy. Those who served Herod well were well taken care of. Now, a while ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, a bishop, a good bishop, not a Herod bishop, a good bishop, asked me to accompany him to various conventions and to various meetings of Anglican bishops, and to help him write statements and to come out with position papers and all this kind of thing. And Over time, I realized that I was being groomed. I was being kind of groomed for something, probably promising out there in the future. Now, that could have been an avenue to some pretty big things for me. And at the time, Good Shepherd was much smaller than it is now, and was also, like, we're just heading into the lawsuit time. So it was really conflictual and difficult time in the church. There were lots of headaches. And so I was very, very tempted to kind of shirk my responsibilities here and kind of glom on to this great bishop. Now, let me say, there's nothing wrong with serving kings or serving bishops. The grooming that he was doing wasn't wrong in itself, and that's fine. But I'll tell you what was going on in my heart. If I would have taken that road, it would have not been for the extension of God's kingdom. That would not have been my motive. Or the commission of the church. It would have been, I do this, I get lots of stuff that I'm not going to get if I stay. So there was, for lack of a better word, a profit motive there. I do this, I get lots of stuff that I don't have now. Now, I think that's the Herodian leaven. The Herodians were kind of shirking their identity and responsibility as members of the body of Israel in order to serve and promote the interests of Herod, and the rewards were great. The rewards would have been great. Herod would provide all the bread they would ever want or need. Be with the right people, make the right career choices, and the world is yours. And we have to say that perhaps that's true. But the lie is that the world will be enough. That it will be enough. So think about it. Step back here for a minute. Both the Pharisees and the Herodians really do offer the same leaven. Either you earn enough through the law, or you get enough through Herod. Both obscure the truth that there's not enough anywhere in the world or in the self. There's just not enough. Both obscure that truth. And so Jesus, taking the disciples' recognition that they don't have enough bread, says again, yes, you don't have enough bread. And the implication is, I do. I do. Now, verse 15 indicates that Jesus didn't just give them a one-liner, because it seems like, wow, I can understand them not getting it, because Jesus kind of just said this one line here. It wasn't a one-liner. The Greek indicates that he taught them. He cautioned them over and over again, saying, watch out, beware. Now, watch out, the Greek there, it means to know and understand the teachings of the Pharisees and the Herodians. Know them. Be familiar with them. Understand them. Be familiar enough with them to know where the lie is there, is basically what Jesus is saying. And then beware is to guard against them, to guard against their influence in your life and in the life of, of your followers, of the future church. Watch out and beware. Now, the New Testament is very, very serious about false teaching. Here I'm going to have you turn to Matthew chapter 7, verse 15. Many of you are familiar with this passage, but I just want to point it out to you again. The New Testament, the Gospels, are very serious about false teaching because Jesus was very serious about it. You can see in verse 15, Matthew 7, verse 15, same Greek word there, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing. Now, that's not dressed up like a sheep. That's dressed up like a prophet, right? Because prophets wore hides, or John the Baptist wore camel hair. Many prophets were known to cover themselves in sheep's wool. Beware of prophets in sheep's clothing, or false prophets that come to you dressed like teachers, dressed like prophets, dressed like leaders. Beware of them and test them by their fruit. And the fruit there is their teaching, what they say. What they say in accordance with what Jesus has said. So think about it. These men, the 12, are going to be teachers of his church. And Jesus is here modeling for them. In Mark 8 and in Matthew 7, he's telling them that they are also to be guarding the flock against false teaching, against enemies who will come in and try to destroy. They must be able and they must be willing to identify wolves. Willing and able to identify wolves. That's what Jesus does here, turning back now to Mark 8. He is identifying wolves who harm the flock. Now that's a hard concept for us when Jesus charges the leaders of his future church to identify and to guard against wolves. It's a hard thing for us. I was listening to a debate this week between a oneness Pentecostal. You know what a oneness Pentecostal is? Anyone? That's someone who believes there's no Trinity, that God sometimes plays the Son, sometimes plays the Father, sometimes plays the Holy Spirit, but he's not all three persons in one being. He just kind of plays those. I was listening to a debate between a oneness Pentecostal person. T.D. Jakes, by the way, is oneness Pentecostal. Stay away from that guy. He does not believe in the Trinity. Does not believe in the Trinity. Against a Christian who professes the Trinity. And they were debating. Great debate. I loved it. It was awesome. Afterwards, they go through and they interview the people in the crowd who are, by and large, mostly Christian. And almost to a person, I heard comments like this. Well, you know, both sides are kind of right. I can see both sides of this question, and I'm sure the truth lies somewhere in the middle, right? That's where we are as a culture, isn't it? Right. We want everybody to be right. We want to validate everybody's ideas. That's where we are. And doing so, saying both sides are right or the truth is somewhere in the middle, does give the appearance of wisdom. You get to say, you get to think, you know, my spiritual vision is so broad that it cannot be contained in any one set of doctrines. I ascend past all of them and I see over all of them and I can see the truth is greater than all of them. That does give the appearance of wisdom. And it allows you, this is what it really does though in our culture, is it allows you and me, it's Christians, followers, and disciples of Jesus, to get away without watching out. Without watching out. Without thinking deeply about what Jesus teaches and testing every single idea that comes to challenge it. Jesus never, ever presents himself as a moderate synthesis of various religious suggestions. He never does that. He says, I am the truth to which all other propositions must conform. I am the truth. And the hard part is he does expect the same from his disciples. He's modeling it here. The truth doesn't lie somewhere between the Pharisees and Jesus. It doesn't lie somewhere between the Pharisees and Jesus. There's no middle way in this account. There is Jesus' way, and there is the wrong way. There is the way that leads to death. There is Jesus' way and the other ways, but there's only one right way, and that's his way. His disciples must know the difference between the false and the true. Now, in this case, again, the false is any sense that you and I have enough or can get enough apart from Christ. Let's see if the disciples receive and understand this teaching. Verse 16. And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. Right? I mean, whoosh, just right over their heads. I mean, it's not like Jesus gave a one-liner. He's been cautioning and teaching and teaching, and boom, just went right over their heads. And they're discussing about the fact they have no bread. They could be arguing about who forgot it, who knows what they're doing, but they do not understand what Jesus wanted them to understand. Now, I think there's two things here. The first is a bit of a Martha episode. Remember Martha and Mary? Jesus goes to visit Martha and Mary, and as soon as he shows up, what does Martha do? I have nothing to, there's no food here, I gotta get, she goes, messes around in the kitchen to prepare food, and then Mary, her sister, though, sits there and listens to Jesus teach, and then Martha, after a while, understandably, I think, gets upset, and she goes, and she tells Jesus, why isn't Mary helping me? And Jesus says, well, Mary has chosen the better thing. I think what Martha's deal is Martha was a kind of person who was always consumed with what needs to be done, how it needs to be done, when it needs to be done, whether it's been done, where it should be done, how it should be done. So she really didn't have the time to sit and listen to Jesus speak. And I think here the disciples have something of that in them. They're consumed with the practical difficulties posed by the lack of bread. And so they're stressing out about it. And so while Jesus is teaching, they're stressing. Has that ever happened to you in church? Right? Like, there's a sermon going on and you've got like lots of other stuff going on in your life and you're just kind of stressing about this other stuff. That's kind of a Martha thing. I think it's going on here. The second thing also is a little kernel of pride. A little kernel of pride. This may just be me, but I don't think so. When I fail, I spend a lot of time going back over that failure in my head, just thinking what I could have done right, why I didn't do it right, and then worse, thinking about the consequences that are now going to come because I didn't do it right. Right? If you're like me and you think everything kind of hangs on your performance, like we're talking about, when I make a mistake, when I fail at my job, I just assume the church is going to collapse and die the next Sunday, and no one's going to show up. That's just the way I go. I have this. The reason that is, I have this image of an Uber pastor, like excellent preacher, teacher, never forgets anything, great at administration, and I want to be that image. And every time I fail, it brings reality to bear on that image. And I just can't stand that. It turns over in my head. I don't think I'm the same. Am I the only one here? Is anyone else like that? You want to be something, and you're not that thing, right? And every time you fail, you know you're not that thing. All right. So I don't get over it easily, and Ann tells me all the time, don't worry, trust God. And I say, you don't know what you're talking about. You can't trust God in this case. But I mess everything up. And so here are these men. Think about the image here. Here are these men with Jesus. They've recognized rightly they don't have bread. They don't have enough bread. Jesus uses that recognition to teach them to beware of those who think they have enough bread, but they can't hear him because they're focused on the bread problem, right? It's a comedy here. Jesus uses their recognition they don't have bread to teach them to beware of those who think they have bread, but they're so upset about not having bread, they can't hear it. And they're with Jesus. Now, do you see why he might be just a little bit exasperated at this point? Do you see it maybe a little bit? So he asked, verse 17, why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread. Do you not perceive yet? Do you not yet perceive? Do you not understand? Are your hearts hardened? Guys, you have been with me from the beginning. You've heard all my sermons. You've seen all my miracles. You recognize that you don't have bread. Good. But you don't see that you have me? Are you so myopically focused on your failure, on your mistakes, on your sin, that you can't see my sufficiency? Don't you understand who I am? Are you hardened like the Pharisees? Having eyes, verse 18, do you not see? Having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? Now think about it. 11 of these guys don't have hard hearts. They don't have hard hearts. They've been given new hearts. But they still haven't learned to trust Jesus. They still haven't learned to trust Jesus. They still haven't learned that their sins and their failures and their shortcomings, their lack of the right stuff, their insufficiency, is really a call to lean on Jesus' sufficiency. They haven't gotten that yet. Now just think back over the last 5 years of your life. 6 years, 7 years, however long back you want to go. How many times have you said to yourself, this is utter disaster. This is a hole that I'm not going to be able to get out of. This is a problem I'm just unable, I'm not going to get out of this. It's over. Done. How many times have you said that? And what's happened every single time? You got out of it. God, every single time, if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, every single time, God has demonstrated himself. He's proved himself to be faithful to you. I know this. It's happened to me. But even so, I'll tell you what, I am just one failure. I'm just one heartbreak. I'm just one disaster from just forgetting all of that. That's what we do. That's what humans do. We get stuck. Something happens and just like a memory goes out. And all the things God's done leading us up to the point where we are in our lives, just we forget it. It's as if he's not done nothing for us ever. Here we are. He's going to let us die in our sin. See, I think we're good in the sense that we see clearly, I'll just speak about myself, I see clearly that I have no bread, but I make myself blind to the truth that Jesus is with me and will never leave me or forsake me and that I can trust him. So I'm really good at the no bread part, but not good at the Jesus part. I think that's where many of us are. I think that's where the 12 are at this point. But Jesus is patient. Let's look at what he does. He walks his disciples through the math. All right, guys, think about it. Verse 19, when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? 12. Good. Correct. Right, so you started off with an insufficient amount of bread. You gave what you had to me, and then you had more than you can eat. You see that, guys? All right. Verse 20. And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? And they said to him, 7. Good. We're getting somewhere. Right? This is what God does for you in your life, I think. When you get to that point of despair, this is what you should try to do yourself, maybe, is go back and remember. Remember those points of deliverance in your life. So Jesus is saying, I did this twice, and now you're in the very same place. You don't have enough bread. What should you do? What should you do? Verse 21, do you not understand? And the text ends with, do you not understand? That's great. And you know what? I don't think they understood yet. Their sight at this point in the Gospel of Mark is fuzzy. They see partially, but not fully. They can't see beyond their shortcomings and sins and failures, and so they cannot see Jesus' excellence and his goodness and his all-sufficiency. How many of us are there this morning? If you are, you're in a good place. Speaking of the church, not that particular psychological place, but you are in a good place. This morning, shift your focus. Shift your eyes from you and your sin and your failure, and focus on Jesus and his love and his excellence and his beauty and his providence. Stop there and pray.